we had one, my first job in New Zealand, we weren't delivering to the I guess the regulator in the way that they would like. And so the pressure was on for us to change, otherwise we'd lose money. And obviously the knock-on effect of that would be people's jobs. And we turned that around. I was head of projects for the Ministry of Justice when we had the Christchurch earthquake in New Zealand.
Oh,
And the
wow.
response of the team was absolutely fantastic. So because that was a bit of a challenge, we had to literally stop doing lots of things and start doing lots of other things. And you really get a sense of people's flexibility, agility, resilience, all of those things there. Fortunate to work with lots of great people who just knew how to get the job done. Really, Nigel. I never, you know, I and I tell project managers this, you know, project managers, it's tough, but you take all of the blame and none of the credit. I think for the things that are successful, the team is the one that does the real work, and it's your job to make sure that the team know what needs to get done and when. And
hi, and welcome to the Sunday Lunch Project Manager podcast for Sunday, the 31st of March, 2024. This is your host, Nigel Creaser, and today I've got the second part of my rerun interview with Colin D. Ellis, the Getting Shit Done guy. Enjoy. So, I have a number of sponsors. Affiliate links in the way that it's set up that have kindly allowed me to share their services, really. The first one is Mike Kling, and Mike runs PM online PM courses, and it is a great resource for getting those fundamentals of project management trained, reasonably priced, and Mike presents it in an accessible and clear manner. You can check out some of his videos on his YouTube channel and kind of give you a view of where they are. But the code for that, if you go to nigelcreaser.com/onlinepmcourses, all one word, lowercase, that'll redirect you to it. There's varying different levels that you can buy. You can buy individual courses, you can buy pathways as well, if you like. And I get a kickback off those. Mike kindly shares me that. So if you do jump on and use it, I hope you find it really useful. I think he has money back guarantees and things like that as well. So there's very limited risk on that. So jump on that. And that again is nigelcreaser.com/onlinepm. Courses and enjoy.
With that project, that being your first one,
yeah.
Moving on now, looking at your stalking you on LinkedIn, as I do with all of my interviewees, there's a vast array of different projects and roles that you've been doing. Thinking about the projects you've done, what would you say was the largest project? And when I say largest, I don't mean what was the biggest value, what was the biggest number of resources. It's what felt the biggest to you, and that might have been impact on the end customer, or impact on the business you're in, or whatever, or impact on the people involved. Whatever felt like the most significant project to you, and in that project, what did you learn?
I had a bit of a rapid rise, Nigel. There are some project managers out there who've managed like a billion projects. I didn't manage a billion projects. I was very fortunate in, at the end of the Y2K stuff, the Mirror Group, as it was then, said we need to establish a central, what they call, program office at the time. That was in 2003. And you're the guy to head it up. Of course, I didn't know what I was doing then either. So I was making that up as I went along. So in terms of the biggest project, because you know, I went on to program management. I did a fair bit of program management. We had some big initiatives then. Specifically within the Mirror Group, we wanted to go from the biggest to the best, because we weren't the best newspaper group, but we were the biggest. So we had a number of program initiatives, and I did some program management within there. But I haven't managed billions and billions of projects, but the ones that I did, I managed really, really well. The biggest learning curves definitely came at the start, because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And I decided early on to become the best at project management, better than anybody else. That's what I decided.
Cool.
And what I found, I'm not suggesting for 1 minute that I was the best, by the way, but I decided that I wanted to become the best. And so I researched it and I learned it and I learned all of the techniques. I was like a sponge. And so all of the things that I did, definitely the early projects were definitely my best. And the whole leadership thing was really, really interesting to me, because I'd worked for some people that I just didn't like. And I didn't like them because it was a personality clash or whatever, but also didn't like it because they didn't set work in the way that I wanted to. And I had a great boss who I watched, and I used to write things down. I still do this now, write things down that I see that I like and think, okay, how can I do that? You know, particularly when I watching people speak or hearing people talk about culture. And so the biggest thing that I learned was definitely early on in my career is by watching people and their interactions with others and finding out what's effective. And that's how I learned to communicate in different ways. So that it's, again, early on in my project management career, but still one of the things that I learned was, how do I change my style depending on the person that I'm talking to? Because when I first started as a project manager, I had a group of developers and they just weren't listening to me. And I went to my boss, I'm paraphrasing now, I can't remember exactly what I said, but I was like, these guys are idiots. Like, none of them are listening. None of them do what I want to do, blah, 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 blah. What we need to do. He's like, maybe you're the idiot. I was like, what? He's like, maybe you're the idiot. Have you thought about the fact that they might not like the way that you're talking to them? I was like, I'm not being rude. He's like, no, I'm not saying that. He's like, but have you ever thought that actually the way to motivate somebody is to find a way that they like to communicate and speak like that? I'd never thought of that before. Never thought of that before. And so I learned how to communicate probably in about four different ways, which, you know, I later found out matched Carl Jung's work, a theory of personality and all that stuff. And that was the best thing that I learned, that if you can change the way that you communicate and if you're resilient, that eventually what you can do is build teams that everyone wants to be a part of. Because they know that not only do you respect what they know, but that you also respect the way that they do things. And we call it empathy these days. Mm. But yeah, that was possibly the most important thing I ever learned.
Yeah, it sounds familiar. And I picked up, I was given a book many years ago. And I think the guy's name was Dr. Robert Rom. And he talked about the DISC behavioral
model.
Yeah. And then subsequent to that, I started listening to a podcast called Manager Tools, which is two guys, Mark Ozan and Mark Horseman. They go into incredible depth around the behaviors of the four models, those, and they, I think they map onto those Carl Jung things as well, and they really emphasize the fact that you've got these behaviors, how you like to be communicated to, what your defaults are, and the fact that everybody else's defaults are different, and how simple things you can do by considering other people's way of communicating can make life so much easier for you, especially with things like email, because they talk about the fact that like me, I'm a fairly flaky at the best of times, and if someone sends me a long email with lots of detail, like, oh, I'll read that in a minute, I'll give that some attention, and it goes on the back burner. If I trust the person, and I've got a few guys who've worked for me before now who said we should do this, And I've gone, yeah, do it. And it's like, hang on, I haven't told you all the details yet. And well, you'll have done that. I trust you to have done a much better job about whether it's the right decision or not than me. And I'll take your word for it. And quite often, if you present that to people, they'll go, well, yeah, you said it's the right thing to do. I've got the background. I can pick that up later. But the problem is you'll send someone a long, long email. They've got to read all the way through it. And at the bottom, they're asked for a decision. Then you've got to read it again and as well. And it kind of, there's lots of little things they give you tips on just to, as you say, adapt to other people's way of communicating rather than thinking everyone's happy with your wonderful way of communicating.
Well, you know, and often, Nigel, you know, I used to inherit teams and they were like, oh, this guy's a poor performer, this guy's a poor performer. And you dig into it and they're technically very good, but just no one's ever changed their style to meet their style. Yeah. And so I was just going to my teams, you know, create a career of doing things slightly differently. I would say, oh, I don't like email. Don't send me any emails. Like, literally don't send me any emails. If you want a decision, come and talk to me. That's my preferred style. If you feel the need to explain yourself, do it face to face. Don't do it on an email. Don't copy me into any emails. I set up a rule. If you copy me into an email, it goes straight into my trash.
Yeah, I put it right? I put all mine into a separate thing as well.
Yeah. So all of a sudden I'm getting no emails and all of my peers, all my senior execs are like, why do you get no emails? Like, because I tell people not to send me emails. How hard can that be? But for everybody else, you know, I very much communicate in the way that they want to learn. But of course, we're not taught this in Prince 2. We're not taught it in PMBOK. We're not taught it in Agile. We're just taught techniques and methods. And yet, the most important thing, you know, the best projects are a result of the people that lead them and the environment that they create. But that whole concept of what does it mean to be a leader and how do you create great teams somehow is secondary to all of the technical stuff. And yet that's the stuff that gets the project delivered. And it still baffles me to this day. I'm still on this, you know, I've been doing it, for about 4 years now. And I still come across these people like, oh, well, surely if I get my PMP qualification, I'm a project manager. I'm like, dude, that gets you a foot in the door. It gets you a foot in the door in project management. Now go and apply that and you'll find out the real world is very, very different. They don't want to follow an 8-step scoping process. That's not how it works in the real life. But you've got to have the badges. You've got to do all of the things, right? You've got to have the badges.
Yeah.
That's your professional development, but that's not the reality of project management.
Yeah, and I think it's that concept of, and I can't remember who I talked to about this. It's like learning a musical instrument. If you're going to learn to play guitar, you need to learn how to play classical guitar and learn to play it perfectly well. So that, it's a friend of mine is a guitar, so you need to be able to learn to play it well. So then you can start to learn to play it off the rules.
Yeah.
Like. Yeah. You know the rules. So you know what, okay, I understand the rules. I understand why I'm doing the rules. Right. Okay. So that one I ain't going to bother with on this project because I don't need to. And you kind of, you adapt those tools you need and you make the right level of governance. And again, it's, I'm sure I was reading in Peter's book the other day, Pete Taylor's, is that he talks about the fact that your communication is the lion's share of a project manager's job is about the communication. And most of the tools that we look at in the project manager's kit bag are about different, like Microsoft Project isn't a planning tool, it's a communication tool. Do you know what I mean? That's what it's for, is to be a Gantt chart is a way of representing the timeline on a plan, the schedule on a plan. So that inherently in it is a communication tool. It's not a planning
tool. Well, I slightly disagree. It's a way of capturing information so that as a project manager, you can answer the questions. I used to hate it when project managers used to send Gantt charts around, though.
It's a tool. You use it. Yeah, you can't paint a wall by sending someone a paintbrush.
No, exactly. Yeah,
do you know what I mean? But you can use that. You can use a Gantt chart. You'll send it right. There's a Gantt chart. I can talk you through it. But it's a tool you can use as part of an illustration, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So kind of moving on from the largest then and what you learned on that, more of a juicy question here. What is the biggest screw-up that you've had in your project management career? And what did you learn from that?
Well, you know, our lives are defined by screw-ups, I think, Nigel. Yeah. The biggest one ever, though, when I went to my first program office, so this is 2003-04, is I decided, I'm going to love this one. I still got it somewhere as well. I decided that what we needed, because my boss at the time said what we need is rigor across the portfolio. So I was heading up, I guess, the program office for the entire organization. Right, particularly in IT, we need a consistent way of managing IT projects. And what I did was I conveniently threw out the things that had made us successful in Y2K, all of the communication, all the team building stuff. Yeah, I threw all of that out of the window. I thought, well, the way to get consistency is to apply a method, because that's the right thing to do. And so we arranged for everyone to have Prince 2 training, 3-day Prince 2 training. I rewrote the 450-page Prince 2 manual into 60 pages or 58 pages, something like that. And I've still got it somewhere. And I decided that that's what I would do, is send that out to everybody. And actually, if everyone could just follow this process, it would be successful. And of course, it failed massively. And no one did it. And no one got anything in on time. And I blamed everybody but myself. Because I'd forgotten about all of the things that actually make projects successful. Slavishly following a method just isn't the thing. I didn't make it about capability improvement. I didn't visit the sites and talk about the challenges that they faced. I didn't upskill people in how to communicate in different ways. I didn't give many instruction on how to create great teams. And so I was given the chance to correct it, which I was hugely grateful for at the time. So we started to do some of those things. I had a really couple of people who worked with me, and they were awesome. And, you know, we really changed the way that we did things. But yeah, that was the biggest screw up, to think that that would work. And yet it was such a great thing to learn back in 2003-04, whenever it was, because it really set the tone for the way that I did things then moving forward in my career, particularly in project management, is when everybody else was doing that, I already knew it didn't work.
Yeah.
I already knew that that approach didn't work. I already knew that telling project managers that if you follow the system, you'll be successful just was never going to be the right thing. So that was the biggest screw up. There have been lots of minor screw ups along the way, particularly around communication, not getting communication right. But they were speed bumps. And, you know, what I would do is write down what I learned in order that I could change, and then worked hard at the change, really. Yeah.
Cool. So let's move back into a bit more positive.
Yeah, please. So it's killing me. Yeah. I need a therapy session after this.
Yeah. There's a few positives after this. You'll have forgotten about that conversation. through your career, there's going to be some deliveries that you're going to have been involved with, and that you'd have taken a lot of pride from. That success and those deliveries, and what would you highlight as being your proudest project program delivery?
For me it was the proudest times of when I've headed up the big teams and faced a significant challenges in that time. You know, we had one, my first job in New Zealand, we weren't delivering to the I guess the regulator in the way that they would like. And so the pressure was on for us to change, otherwise we'd lose money. And obviously the knock-on effect of that would be people's jobs. And we turned that around. I was head of projects for the Ministry of Justice when we had the Christchurch earthquake in New Zealand.
Oh, wow.
And the response of the team was absolutely fantastic. Because that was a bit of a challenge. We had to literally stop doing lots of things.
Yeah.
And start doing lots of other things. And you really get a sense of people's flexibility, agility, resilience, all of those things there. But, you know, fortunate to work with lots of great people who just knew how to get the job done. Really, Nigel. I never, you know, I tell project managers this, you know, project managers, it's tough, but you take all of the blame and none of the credit. Yeah. I think for the things that are successful, the team is the one that does the real work, and it's your job to make sure that the team know what needs to get done and when. And so I've been fortunate to be part of some really, really great teams that have done some pretty amazing things.
Brilliant. So outside of the actual deliveries and what they've done, what project-based achievement that you've had would you rate as being your proudest? And not necessarily about the delivery. It could be, well, I don't want to lead the witness sort of thing. What's given you personally the most? You've sat there and thought, yeah, I'm proud of myself there. Or I'm proud of that situation.
Gosh, not great at self-reflecting and finding positives. Not that I'm a negative person, but I don't really look at myself in that way, Nigel. I think, you know, I'm 50 this year. And kind of
welcome
when I
to
look
the club.
Back. Yeah, cheers, thanks. When I look back 23 years ago at what I've learned, I'm proud that I'm still relevant. I'm proud that I can talk a language that people understand. I'm proud that I can stand in front of groups of people, you know, regardless of their generation, and there's something in that message for everyone. I'm proud that I didn't stagnate, that I see lots of project managers do, that they didn't stay wedded to that one thing that they knew. I'm proud that I challenged myself and moved to different roles in different organizations that had different challenges, and, you know, never stopped learning, never stopped meeting people. You know, and I'm proud that at kind of 46, I, you know, with two kids and not a lot of money in the bank, that I decided to follow a bit of a passion and kind of take everything that I've learned and put that back in books, on stage, in facilitated programs to help organizations change the way that they get things done. So I guess there's been a series of moments over that time. I couldn't pick one thing out, but you know, ultimately to still be relevant in 2019, having come from where I came from, is possibly the proudest thing. And it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of effort, but I wouldn't change it for the world.
Brilliant. That kind of leads nicely onto my next question, really, is around how you, what made you start with the with writing and with speaking and taking that step. What was the catalyst in that, really?
I was working in change management for the Ministry of Education in New Zealand. I had quite a big piece of work to do, but I was part of a small change team. And the girl that I was working next to, she was a blogger, and I'd never really thought about blogging. So this is in 2013. And she said, you should write, because, you know, I talk, you should write a blog. Like, why would I write a blog? Who's going to listen to me? Anyway, so she was the catalyst for me thinking about blogging. And then when we emigrated to Australia that year, and so I had a head of projects role for another government department. And, you know, I had a little bit of time on my hands. My job was to change the culture, which I love doing. That's my bag. That's the thing. Everyone's got one thing that's mine. And so I started writing about some of the things. And of course, like, zero people read them to begin with. There was like no people read them. But it was just that I had a viewpoint, Nigel, that I wanted to get off my chest. And I thought, well, if I could write it, maybe somebody would read it and it might change the way that they thought. The real catalyst, though, was I went to a project management conference in Adelaide in 2014. It was rubbish. And I was gutted to have spent the money on it and to be completely underwhelmed. And I was massively underwhelmed over 3 days. I'm like, no one here is talking about the realities that we face. No one here is talking about the actual human skills that we need to be successful. Nobody. And no one here is making it entertaining and interesting to listen to. It was a bunch of pale, male, stale guys just droning on about method. And the way to deliver benefits is, and like we all know, right, the way to deliver benefits is for the sponsor to give a damn, you know? And so I'm writing down all these things, Nigel, and I'm not a moaner. I'm not like, yeah, I could do better. I'm going to moan. I'm like, screw it, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to become a public speaker. I'd done maybe two speeches before then, maybe two or three speeches, mainly because I was a practitioner at organizations and the people invited me to speak hoped that I would bring an army of people with me. That's a cynic's view. And that was in 2014. And so I quit my job. We had no money. I saved up enough money for 3 months' rent. You know, we didn't have a house or anything like that. But so I saved up enough money for 3 months' rent and decided that I would write a project management like training course, and I would try and sell it to local businesses here in Melbourne. But we'd only been here 9 months, so nobody knew me. Like nobody knew me. No one had a clue I was. I didn't have any position in. I wasn't really writing then much. I'd done a few blogs. And so it failed. So I had to get a contract job. So I got a contract job as a PMO manager for a telecommunications company, started to capture all of the stuff that I knew to be true, and then tried again in 2015. That was at the end of my contract. And then I saved up 4 months' rent this time. And my wife at this time was like, "What are you doing? Why, you know, we got two young kids. What the hell is going on?" I'm like, I think I got something. I think I got something." She was like, "Yeah, no, I don't think you do, because no one wants it." And then it couldn't, no traction. No one wanted anything. And I went for an interview at a consultant's office. Now, this is how I remember it. It might not have gone exactly like, but this is definitely how I remember it, is when I was in this consultant's office to have a conversation about a project manager role. I never wanted to be a consultant. I was happy being a contractor. I like, you know, rolling my sleeves up. He had a speaker cancel. He was doing these breakfast sessions that he would invite people in to speak. And he had a speaker, either had a speaker cancel or something came up in the conversation where I said that I could do a speech. And he was like, "Are you a speaker?" I was like, "Yeah, definitely a speaker. Internationally, all over the world." Not a liar, you know. I was talking about the times that I'd done training courses, you know,
in Liverpool,
international, yeah. In Liverpool, yeah, during the Y2K. And anyway, good enough, he gave me this opportunity. He said, "What do you talk about?" I said, "I talk about leadership and team building and project management." I was like, "Because they're the things that people forget about all of the time." And so anyway, he's like, "Okay, yeah, we'll give that a crack." Anyway, long story short, at that session that I ran for like an hour over breakfast with somebody from a retail company, she was like, "Oh my God, love what you're talking about. We've got this challenging transformation program. The thing that's missing is leadership and team building. We can do all the other stuff. Will you come and work with us?" And I was like, "Yes." And she said, "But I'm thinking what we need is something every month." And I was like, "Yep, can totally do that. That's the right way. You know, it's the right way to do personal development." And so the fee that I charged was my monthly rent every month for 12 months. And so I knew that I had the rent covered, and I just needed to find something else to cover the food. And my wife was working, and so she was looking after that side of things. And that was it. And that was the start of it. And for 2015, 2016, I had two clients. That was it. I had one in Melbourne and one in New Zealand, where I still had a really good reputation. And that was it. And that was the start of it. And in that time, then I wrote The Conscious Project Leader, which, you know, I wanted to write a project management book that was real. Not that other people's books aren't real, but certainly real in the way that I'd seen it, and lots of humor. I wanted to do something slightly different. And yes, and that was it, Nigel. So I started to get a little bit of traction from there back in 2015-16.
Brilliant. I'm trying to think about when I first became aware of your work, and I think it's in the last 12 months, so I'm not sure if you were on a podcast or whether I saw it just on LinkedIn or whatever, but the Project Rots from the Head was the next book, which was the one that I remembered the title of that being quite memorable there.
That was, and because I wanted to write a book. Having written a book for project managers, I wanted to write a book for sponsors. Yeah. And I looked at all these books, you know, and yeah, you know, to write a book, as you well know, right, is to write a book, you've got to read lots of books. Mm. And I read, and the titles were all like, "A Guide to Sponsoring Projects," yeah, you know, 10 Things Sponsors Need to Know. I was like, sponsors are idiots. But the reasons that projects fail is because of sponsors. And I was like, I want to make sure that the title represents that. And so there's a Chinese or a Japanese proverb that the fish rots from the head when they talk about organizations and how they fail. And I'm like, yeah, the project rots from the head. And so, yeah, there was a lot. I got a lot of, interest in the book because of the title.
Yeah, which is good. It's ideal, isn't it? It's all about marketing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there's two other things I'm going to have to talk to you about before I close off this around your writing and blogging and things like that. Is two other irons that you have in the fire that I noticed recently. You're the founder and organizer of the Getting Shit Done Club.
Yeah.
And the co-founder of the Whiskey Trip. Do you want to tell us a little bit about those two other irons you've got on the fire?
The latter first. The Whiskey Trip is a passion project, so I do love my whiskey. I'm a quality, not quantity kind of person. And so there are a number of great whiskey bars here in Melbourne. And what I wanted to do was to create like a luxury trip. Because I've had a little bit of success over the last couple of years, and I wanted to treat myself, kind of a way of me celebrating success. And I thought, well, what I want to do is go on like a luxury tour where I get to take in different whiskey distilleries, but also get an experience as well. Yeah. And there was nothing. And so I, working with the manager of a local whiskey bar here in Melbourne, so we put together this whiskey trip. So it's a kind of unique luxury experience. We're doing Tasmania first in Australia, and then hope to do Japan, Scotland, US, lots of different places you can go. Yeah. So that's my passion project. The Getting Shit Done Club is a little bit of a frustration for big corporate conferences. And again, having gone to conferences for 20 years, Nigel, is what they would do is spend all their money on a keynote speaker, and then everybody else was practitioners. Not that that's bad or wrong, because you need that, but sometimes it just needs something a little bit different, and people just want to be motivated, want to be inspired. I've met loads of great public speakers over the last 3 years, and so I thought, well, rather than take people out of the office for 3 days and make them spend $1,500 a ticket or £1,000 a ticket, let's just create a simple half-day thing, low cost. It's all about getting shit done. And, you know, the speakers don't take a fee, and we give all of the money after we've covered our costs to charity, and people can make the time for it. It's half a day. So, you know, you'd be quite prepared to take half a day off work and spend $75 to come and listen to five great speakers, or four and me, great speakers, speak about something, you know. So we cover all of the topics from HR to leadership to project management to vitality and staying fit to, you know, we're working with Atlassian. We've got a speaker from Atlassian in Sydney, Atlassian, big software company, you know, about how they get shit done. And so this was the plan, really, just to create something different in the conference world for people who perhaps can't afford $1,500 a ticket or 3 days out of work. And they've been pretty popular so far, so we're going to keep them going.
Yeah, so I see it. We're looking now. We're in, you've got a few coming up over the next few months. I think this podcast is not going to be going out for a little while, so it's probably not very timely to mention the one in the 5th of June, because we'd probably be after that anyway. Yeah. But
if anyone wants to sponsor a London one, let me know.
that'd be good. I'd find the time to get down to that one. Yep. That's brilliant. I've got some quick fire questions now for the end of this, which is, what was the last project podcast you listened to? If you listen to podcasts, because I know people.
The Digital PM podcast. I'm not a big podcast listener, but the Digital PM podcast is the last one that I listened to. Yeah.
Yeah. And I interviewed Ben. A couple of weeks
Top
ago.
Top guy, Ben.
Yeah. Nice. Really good interview. I think that one's coming out a month after next. Mm. Cool. What's the last blog that you remember reading, that project blog that made any sense, or other blog even?
I subscribe to Elizabeth Harron's blog. I really love Elizabeth's take on things, because it's different than most other people. And so I read that every week, and she just did one yesterday. And so I read that last night. So that was the last one. Or was it this morning? Yeah, it was last night. Yeah, so that's the last one I remember reading. Yeah.
Okay. And crack these ones here now. If you are giving a top tip to a seasoned PM, what's the one thing you're going to say that would make the massive difference to their career as a PM?
The way that people like to be motivated and inspired is different, so you have to change your style. And the way that we build teams today is different than it was. So make sure you stay relevant and learn skills that will make you successful now, not 10 years ago.
Yeah, cool. Brilliant. And the final one, we take you back to when is it? January 1998 or December 1997, whichever, yeah, whenever the conversation was, and you're starting that first day in project management on at the Trinity Mirror Group and your Y2K transformation project. What do you tell Colin? What do you tell young Colin there?
God, what would I tell him? Don't gate crash parties in Middlesbrough. definitely tell him that. Yeah, we did that once. That's a whole other presentation story. What would I tell him? I you know what? Given where I am, I wouldn't change where I am right now, Nigel. So there's not a lot that I would tell him, because it might lead me to a different position, because I'm very, very happy with what I'm doing right now. And I feel like I'm making a difference. You know, I've got another book coming out. The project book is out in July. And so maybe I would tell the young Colin to maybe start writing down some of the things that work, to share them with other people, and then to relentlessly get better at the things that, you know, I don't enjoy. Maybe that's what I would tell him, but I feel like I've done that.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, that is everything I was going to ask you. It's been a really,
I think that's the most I've talked about myself ever, like ever. I'm exhausted.
Yes. And it's quite, as you say, hopefully some of these have, I haven't managed to get anyone to cry on the call yet. So that's my goal.
I'm so crying on the inside. Don't worry. Yeah, I'm starving here. Yeah. Breakfast time.
Oh yeah, of course, yeah. I do appreciate the amount of time you've given me today. It's been a really interesting and entertaining interview. If people want to get in touch with you, want to look at your work, I'll include some links into the show notes. But what would you recommend the best and quickest way to get hold of you?
So LinkedIn is the easiest. So Colin with one L, Colin D. Ellis. So feel free to connect on LinkedIn, and then just ping me a message. That's got my contact info, my website, which is colindellis.com. You can just Google me these days, which is nice that I come up there and, you know, people aren't trolling me yet. I'll get there. I'll definitely get there. And I got a new book out in July, the project book. So that will be marketing that. So you'll see me about the place. But yeah, you know, LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, I do all of the social things.
Okay, brilliant. Well, all I've got to say then is thank you again. And I hope you have a lovely breakfast and have a wonderful rest of the week.
Thanks, Nigel. Great to talk to you, mate.
Thanks, Colin.
Another great sponsor of the show, it comes in the form of Air Manual. Air Manual is it's a tool for documenting process, which and best practices. It's run at a company formed by one of my interviewees, Alexis Kingsbury. Essentially, and I kind of summarised why my view of where we see documentation, a lot of my experience has been, people will document something, a process, they'll put it in a Visio diagram that gets loaded onto a SharePoint site or something similar, and then a bunch of that. So then, once that diagram's been shared with senior management, they're happy they have a process in the business. But then the detailed procedures underneath it might be with documents, just poorly kept and not linked easily and not updated. And what Air Manual does, it allows you to put in it's a tool for doing this kind of thing. You whack it in, the service in there, get in there, put in your process, your flow, and you build it down to as low a level of detail, even to the point of checklists where people can check off they've done it. So it creates that guided checklists, easy to create, easy to maintain, and all in one place. And no one's kind of rooting around to find the SharePoint. And then when you change to new SharePoint services and all that stuff, it's all there. So if you pop along to nigelpriester.com/airmanual, there's a bit more detail there and a link there to click on to go and get, I think they offer a trial and things like that. So it's something that I think can easily reduce the amount of errors, rework, etc. within our organisation. So, yeah, take a look. My latest, the latest affiliate that I've got on the show now is Riverside. I use Riverside to do my interviews, Riverside FM. It kind of offers you a whole, if you like, micro studio management producer tool and goes beyond that. Has a really good free layer. And I've been using it for a while now. I find it really good. When I've had issues, even though I'm not on one of the higher paid levels, the support has been quick, responsive and of high quality, and people keen to help me. The organisation seems really good. The product seems really intuitive. And quality is really good as well. And it's a clever way of doing it is when you're recording through your browsers, so you've not got loads of desktop resources being used compared to some other products that I've used. And what they also do is they do they stream a lower quality version of it up onto as you're doing the interview, so you're not burning bandwidth while you're doing the interview and potentially impacting on the quality of the conversation. And then at the end, it uploads it, the higher quality from your browser. I mean, it's just a really good way of doing it. So if you are thinking of doing a podcast, and know someone's doing a podcast, I would recommend using this tool. I found it really good. Best of the tools that I've tried using to date. And you can get that at nigelcreaser.com/riverside, and that will redirect you to my kickback page on their site, and there I will get a little kickback from them. So take a look. Thanks. Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Colin. Next week, I'm hoping to be back on track, though I'm still a little bit behind with my new recording, so it may be another rerun. I'll just wait and see how things go this week, but enjoy your week and speak soon. Bye. So this is my final wrap-up. Every week you're going to hear this, you're going to get bored of it, but you can always click next podcast if so. If you have enjoyed it, if you listened to this podcast to the end of this show and you think that was great, I'd love to be able to help Nigel out. There are loads of ways you can do it. The first and obvious way is to share the podcast, send it out to people. If you know colleagues and friends who'd benefit from it, you think they'd enjoy it, just send them the link. Grab one of the links or send them to www.nigelcreaser.com/podcasts. That's www.nigelcreaser.com/podcasts. And that will push them over to a Linktree link, and it's got all of the different ways they can consume the podcast. If you are feeling generous and have a big bag of cash, you could grab a copy of one of my books. Obviously, they're available in all the usual places, and print and digital. Again, jump on the website, www.nigelcreaser.com/shop, and that will give you a list of all the different ways that you can contribute and grab copies of the book. Also got links to all my guests' books on there as well, where I get a little bit of a kickback from them. If you are of a sporting mind, I have a number through doing some of my judo and running antics, I've managed to secure a few affiliate links and affiliates there as well. So in there somewhere in the sponsors page, there's links to those as well. So clicking onto those and grabbing if you're looking to get super fit, then that would be fabulous as well. And I get a little kickback from those. I have a Patreon account. It's patreon.com/sundaylunchpm. So again, you can ping something in there, buy me a coffee or whatever. And finally, obviously the most important is coming back, listen again, because the more of you that come back, the more visibility I get, because there's more times that it's downloaded and all the SEO works and things like that. So yeah, that's it. So if you can help me out, I would be much appreciated. If you can't, don't worry about it. Thank you very much. Cheers now. Bye.
Well, it's goodbye from me, Nigel Creaser, and it's goodbye from him, the Sunday Lunch PM. Goodbye.